And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, November 9, 2023. The Biden administration announces funding cuts to humanitarian aid agencies in South Sudan.
And while we've remained deeply committed, worldwide demands on our humanitarian funds will necessitate significant budget reductions here in South Sudan starting in this fiscal year.
And the Catholic community in South Sudan continues to mourn late Bishop Paride Taban.
We are actually crying because we don't know whether we shall get a person like him now. So we are praying at least we shall get someone who is actually faithful like him, and somebody who can actually make a development like what he did.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Biden administration has announced its plans to cut funds for humanitarian programs in South Sudan. A top U.S. diplomat in Juba says increasing humanitarian needs in other parts of the world has forced U.S. to cut its budget for humanitarian assistance in South Sudan. For VOA News, Charlton Doki reports from Juba.
U.S. Ambassador to South Sudan Michael J. Adler says the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan has worsened over the past decade. Ambassador Adler says despite the ongoing humanitarian challenges in South Sudan, the U.S. government will cut its funding for humanitarian response in the country.
And while we've remained deeply committed, worldwide demands on our humanitarian funds will necessitate significant budget reductions here in South Sudan starting in this fiscal year. In that context, we call on the transitional government to increase its own use of public revenue to support humanitarian response and to reduce the costs and risks of aid delivery.
Ambassador Adler spoke in Juba Wednesday at an event to celebrate 10 years of Rapid Response Fund in South Sudan. The fund, managed by the International Organization for Migration, helps aid agencies to respond to acute humanitarian emergencies in South Sudan and the contested Abyei region. Ambassador Adler urged the transitional government of national unity to remove road and riverine checkpoints, reduce bureaucratic impediments, and remove illegal taxes imposed on both international and national aid agencies operating in the country. He calls on the transitional government of national unity to allocate more money for humanitarian assistance to some vulnerable South Sudanese.
Now is the time for the transitional government to fulfill its obligations to its citizens and take immediate steps to provide basic services, including life-saving humanitarian assistance to the most vulnerable.
Manasseh Lomolewaya, head of South Sudan's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, appeals to the Biden administration to reconsider its move.
I would only appeal to the U.S. government to continue giving support to the most vulnerable people in the Republic of South Sudan. Until such a time when we will have come out from these natural calamities, natural disasters, then and only then shall we be able to stand on our own.
Lomole says South Sudan needs the support of donors to address the current influx of refugees and returnees fleeing conflict in Sudan.
If they don't want to support everybody, they must look for the most vulnerable, particularly those who return from the Sudan and are not able to settle down quickly. It will take us time to be able to stand and fill the gap. Let them continue supporting those who are needy, because those are issues that are beyond our expectations and beyond our competency in resolving them.
In May, South Sudan's finance ministry approved $15 million to provide food assistance to returnees and refugees through the UN World Food Programme. Ambassador Adler says by the end of this year, the U.S. government will have contributed more than $100 million for humanitarian support to both South Sudanese returnees and Sudanese refugees who fled the ongoing conflict in Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
Still on Sudan, resurgence in fighting and violence against civilians in El Geneina in Sudan's West Darfur region has forced thousands of people to cross into eastern Chad and South Sudan as refugees, while the majority are trapped inside Sudan. VOA's Anthony Labruto spoke with Khadir Omar, a resident trapped inside Banat within the city of Omdurman, who says RSF forces have allegedly blocked his and surrounding neighborhoods from all humanitarian aid and repairs to infrastructure. Khadir also says RSF forces are allegedly targeting civilians and civilian hospitals in the name of looking for military forces. VOA could not independently verify Khadir's account.
The situation right now in this area is getting worse by the second. We're facing a lot of struggles in life. How could I say this in a more polite way? We're facing a lot of, almost a catastrophe, because we have 1,050 families right here in the area of Banat, of Kadok, and the area surrounding it. And we have people that move, refugees from more dangerous places like Mugran and Moreda. Those are places where the RSF forces are taking control, which is more dangerous. So in these areas, or the families that move from these areas to Banat are like almost 500 to 600 families. Each family is from 5 up to 7 people, like containing 5 up to 7 people. So now, like today, we're facing the problem of the lack of food, essential food. Like I'm saying, I'm talking about sugar, flour, salt, the essential food, the things that people could use to survive, just survive. So in the morning today, in this morning, these 1,500 families put their names in a list, or on a list to in order for us to sell them with the lower prices, to sell them flour that we could find or gather from just how can I say this? We gather flour by the most illegal ways that you can find in this on. So on these families today, we only served 100 families. In this apartment, 100 families. So we have 1,400 families that couldn't find. This is the essential, the least thing that you could just give to a person to survive. When I'm talking about food, concerning medicine, the situation is very bad. We don't have life saving medicines like people with terminal diseases or diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure. Even the older people, we can't find these medicines. It's very bad. I don't know how to describe this, but this is very bad.
So what's stopping this humanitarian access? You know, there's 1,400 families that are stuck within this area, within Omdurman. Who's stopping everything from happening?
Well, to be honest, the problem is happening from the RSF force, because they are the ones that are putting the area of Banat. This area is in the middle of Omdurman. So we have, if we divide Omdurman to three parts, the first part of Omdurman, which is Kerry, is governed by the military, which is better than here. The place there is way better than here. This area is in the middle of Omdurman, which is the area of Moreda, Abbasia, Banat. This area, those are all around or surrounding the compound of Omdurman military base. So the RSF forces are putting the Muhandisin military compound under siege.
That's Khadir Omar, a resident trapped inside Banat in Omdurman. As I said earlier, VOA could not independently verify Khadir's accounts. He spoke with my colleague Anthony Lobruto from Omdurman this past hour. One of the Central Equatorial State ministers facing a looming impeachment denied he and his colleagues sold the land in Juba. Plans by lawmakers in Central Equatorial State to impeach three ministers over allegations of land deals have hit a deadlock after some lawmakers walked out of a session on Wednesday. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayer reports from Juba.
Central Equatorial State lawmakers summoned the State Minister of Finance, Viana Kakuli Agri, and State Minister of Cabinet Affairs, Wai Godwill, to answer charges regarding the sale of a public land in Juba suburb of Haimalakal. Maurice Andrea, Deputy Chairperson for the Information Committee at the Central Equatorial State Legislative Assembly, says the lawmakers decided to move a motion for a vote of no confidence against the three state ministers scheduled for Wednesday.
On Monday, there was a sitting on the same issue, and the motion was adopted, and we are supposed to continue the sitting for today. Was just simply adjourned by his Honorable Speaker. Some of the members moved out of the House. The quorum was not enough, so that is why it is adjourned until further notice.
Gary Iskopas, an SPLMIO lawmaker, says the state parliament is largely divided along party lines, making it difficult to reach a final decision on the fate of the three ministers.
And to be clear, they were the members of the SPLMIG who walked out in defense of their honorable ministers. But we have a member also from the SPLMIO. But we, the members of SPLMIO, do not stand to support our member because he is from our party. No, we are standing with the rights of the people of Central Equatorial State, not defending political parties.
Two of the three ministers facing impeachment are from the ruling SPLM group led by President Salva Kiir, while the other belongs to the SPLMIO. Iskopas says the parliamentary committee tasked with the investigation of the three ministers has presented its findings regarding the alleged land sales.
The said plot was leased by then Jubek State to Shai Petroleum Company for 27 years. When the country was reverted back to 10 states, Central Equatorial State went and renewed the contract. Instead of 27 years, it has gone to 30-something years. The contract is up to 2055 at $4,000 per month. Now, the same state ministry of finance sold this land to a Quick Global Company. Now, when the documents of the sale of the lands were retrieved, then there was the motion for the vote of no confidence.
Joy KG is one of the MPs against the move to impeach the three ministers. She says the vote of no confidence against ministers was premature.
He could have waited until the recommendation is taken to the house, to the governor. If the minister did not implement the recommendations that are passed in this August house for the same cited plot, can it's okay. Now I'm not sure if the recommendation has reached the governor. Immediately, he rose to bring this motion of vote of no confidence.
KJ, who was part of the investigation committee, said the state parliament had filed some recommendations for the three ministers to implement, including revoking of the sale agreement of the said piece of land. Viana Kakuli, Central Equatorial State Finance Minister, who is among the three ministers facing impeachment, declined to comment on this story. But Wai Godwill, the State Minister of Cabinet Affairs, who is also on the list of ministers facing impeachment, says the issue was resolved in Parliament some time back.
We were summoned to appear in the Parliament, and we did appear and presented our answers, which they had sought from us. And thereafter, they also formed a committee to gather some other information, which they did, and then a report was submitted to Parliament. We were even invited to attend the reading of the report. So I was there when the report was being read, and it was unanimously passed. So I was surprised to hear something else.
Fred Laku is State Minister for Land, Housing and Public Utilities, and one of the accused ministers denies that there was a piece of land sold.
They are lying. We told them last time, let them give us the document. Actually, the minister was requesting the approval to sell that land, but the land was not sold out. Then they start saying that we lied to them.
He says the lawmakers have no rights to impeach him and his colleagues because they have committed nothing wrong. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Catholics around South Sudan are mourning late Bishop Padre Taban. That story is coming up right after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The South Sudanese Catholic community are continuing to pay tribute to the late Bishop Emeritus Paride Taban, who passed away in Nairobi, Kenya, last week. They described the late bishop as an icon whose legacy will never fade. Some of the Catholics who spoke to VOA in Juba say the late Bishop Taban has contributed to restoring peace and bringing development to several communities across South Sudan. For VOA News, Viola Elias spoke to some Catholics around Juba town.
The body of late Bishop Emeritus Paride Taban was flown to Juba on Tuesday, where taken to St. Teresa Cathedral in Kator, a funeral mass, and the body was later flown to Nimule in Eastern Equatorial State, and then to Torit, where the late bishop will be buried. Richard Robert, a Juba resident and Catholic, described late Bishop Paride Taban as a faithful father and a peacemaker, adding that his death leaves a huge gap within the Catholic community and the country.
We are actually crying because we don't know whether we shall get a person like him now. So we are praying at least we shall get someone who is actually faithful like him, and somebody who can actually make a development like what he did, because he's the father of all the Christians.
Another Juba resident, Sambro Lupai, says the late Bishop Taban was an icon and an influencer, peacemaker, respected by people around the world. Lupai says the late Bishop Taban helped his family to escape from Juba for Nairobi during the 2016 conflict.
I was not allowed to leave the airport, but because we used his name just to go and meet him in Nairobi and hand him his bag, we got access through the airport to be able to leave the country during the time of conflict. And that alone speaks about the kind of work and influence and respect everybody in the country has, whether you're in the government, whether you're just a civilian, or even if you're in the opposition. Bishop Paride Taban, however, for so many years have worked in different communities bringing peace.
Helen Teso, a Catholic nun with the Holy Family Chapel in Western Equatorial State, says she met the late Bishop Paride Taban during a bishop conference in Yambio. Sister Teso says the late Paride was a peaceful man who treats people equally.
He really stood for peace, and we should remember him either by schools, peace schools, or church school, so that he cannot be forgotten, because he have done a lot to the church, to the world. Really, we have lost somebody within the church. We have lost a lovable man, a man who loves everybody without any discrimination.
Father Sebastian Angu of the Apostle of Jesus says the Catholic communion still mourns the late bishop.
He is being remembered worldwide. He's a man of peace. He brings peace. He reconciles brothers and sisters. In the place where there is no peace, he made it to be a place of peaceful coexistence. And that is what we can remember him out of. If we can follow, we are able to reconcile our brothers and sisters. We see Christ in each one of them. He has done for us. It is for us to take the footstep if we can follow the legacy he left behind.
Late Bishop Emeritus Paride Taban was the first leader of the Sudan Council of Churches, which was founded in February 1990. In the 1980s, late Taban was an auxiliary bishop of Juba and bishop of Torit in 1983. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Businesses in the Ethiopian traditional clothing market say cheaper garments made by Chinese manufacturers is driving them out of work. Kennedy Abate has this report from the capital Addis Ababa, narrated by Vincent Macori.
This is Shiromeda Market in Ethiopia's capital city, Addis Ababa. Most shops here sell Ethiopian traditional clothes that are made of woven cotton. Business owners say they earned a decent income until Chinese companies started producing similar items made of chiffon. Meron Asrat is the owner of a traditional dress shop in Shiromeda. She says the competition is unfair.
There are no new buyers except for some of my own customers. The chiffons manufactured in China can't be a replacement for our traditional clothes. But people are moving toward the cheaper ones from an economic point of view.
Jamil Taha Abdu has a shop next door. He says Chinese manufactured clothes are hurting the markets because of the price difference compared with clothes that are handmade locally.
It will be 3 or 4 times cheaper. We cannot compete with them. And people want to spend where there's a discount because life is a little difficult now.
Jamil said the clothes imported from China have created an uneven playing field in the market. But to stay in business, he says that he has started selling Chinese clothes as well.
We spent so much time without sleep on designing. Then in a week, the Chinese products flooded the market. That means you can't compete with them. So you become a prisoner against your will.
Enda Shashwobe, a customer, says price is what makes shoppers turn to Chinese clothes. Here, she bought a traditional netala, a handmade scarf-like clothing that is made of cotton.
The price of Chinese-made chiffon is better, but the quality of Ethiopian traditional clothes is better.
Birknesh Sugebu, another customer, shares Endeshesh's sentiments.
I came here to buy traditional clothes to send to other places, but it is very expensive. The Chinese counterfeit product is cheap and lower in terms of quality than what's woven by hand. But because of the cheaper price, people buy those counterfeit products.
Some business owners are asking the government to provide protection for traditional clothing weavers, garment makers, sellers, and other Ethiopians involved in the traditional clothing market. For Kennedy Abate, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and Vincent Macori, VOA News.
Voters in the Minnesota city of St. Louis Park elected Nadia Muhammad, a 27-year-old Somali-American, as the first Black, first Somali, and first Muslim mayor in the Midwestern state's election Tuesday night. She spoke with VOA's Somali service about her win.
This means the world to me. This means that we get the representation that we so deserve. It feels amazing to be the mayor of a city in which I immigrated to 18 years ago, and to be the first Black mayor, to be the first Somali mayor, to be the first Somali mayor and the youngest mayor. I think it was everybody. I think it was the help and support of everybody. I definitely know it was with the help and support of everybody who encouraged me to run, who kept calling me and saying, you got it, you got it, you got it. Everybody who went door knocking, everybody who told somebody about it. So this is all of our win. I think it means that we can do anything. We're coming to a chapter of America where we make the impossible happen, where we get representations everywhere, where whether we are Somalis, Black Americans, African Americans, Latinx, whatever it may be.
Mohammed's family moved to the small city when she was 10 years old. She became the first Somali-American mayor elected directly by voters in the northwestern state of Maine, Dakhla, became the first Somali-American to serve as mayor of an American city in 2021, when South Portland's 6th member council elected her for the role. And we now move to Gaza, where Arab allies of the United States continue to press for a ceasefire in the Israeli-Hamas war as Palestinian civilian deaths mount at an alarming scale in Gaza. Analysts say as anger grows on the Arab streets over civilian casualties and enormous destruction, Arab leaders worry that the security of their countries and potentially the entire region is increasingly at risk. Dail Gavlak reports from Amman.
Mideast analyst Nicholas Harris of the Washington-based New Lines Institute for Strategy and Policy points to U.S. allies Egypt and Jordan as Arab states that are playing a particularly pivotal role in Israel's conflict with Hamas. The two countries have the region's longest-lasting peace treaties with Israel and have had close intelligence and security cooperation with the Jewish state. Jordan's King Abdullah hosted a meeting last week between U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and the heads of several Arab countries. The Arab leaders insisted on an urgent ceasefire to bring in badly needed medical and humanitarian aid for Gaza's civilians who are facing death and destruction from Israeli bombardment of Hamas militants. The U.S. and other G7 countries have pressed Israel to allow humanitarian pauses and corridors to allow for the delivery of aid and the release of hostages. Harris told VOA that Egypt and Jordan are vigorously working for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and would reject any Israeli moves to forcibly displace Palestinians into their countries. He said that concern is particularly acute for Jordan.
Both those countries have potential to have very restive and angry populations turning on their governments. Jordan has dealt pragmatically with Israel, but it is also exposed in a lot of ways because the majority of the population of Jordan happens to be Palestinian by descent. Jordan has responsibility for the Islamic holy sites in Jerusalem. Jordan is a country that even before this conflict erupted was under severe economic pressure that has led to an increase in socio-political activism.
The whole region is sinking into a sea of hatred that will define generations to come, Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi warned. He said that any day after scenario for Gaza is not going to be discussed except after the war and the killing are stopped. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have condemned Israel's conduct in the war. Bahrain has cut business ties with Israel, while Jordan and Turkey have withdrawn their ambassadors. The Organization for the Islamic Conference will host a summit on Gaza in Saudi Arabia on Saturday. Long-term resentment among the Arab public is fuel for extremist groups. Elham Fakhro, an associate fellow at Chatham House's Middle East program in London, told the New York Times, adding, "The region is already walking a delicate balance." The conflict has already spread from Gaza to the West Bank. Bruce Riddell, Emeritus Senior Fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution, told VOA.
What began as a war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza has now spread to a war between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Much of it caused by settler violence. American allies like King Abdullah, the Bahrainis, are feeling very threatened. They're pleading with the Americans to get the Israelis to stop the bombardment of Gaza.
I will say very candidly, this conflict has roiled up a huge amount of public anger towards Israel, towards us. Barbara Leaf, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, told the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee this week, "This is something we're going to have to work through." Meanwhile, the Jordanian Air Force on Sunday airdropped tons of urgent medical supplies to its field hospital operating in Gaza under difficult conditions. The action was taken in coordination with Israel. Israel's blockade and siege of Gaza have put some hospitals out of service. Humanitarian agencies report that aid deliveries through the Rafah border crossing with Egypt have so far been inadequate as essential services in Gaza deteriorate. Dale Gavlak, VOA News, Amman, Jordan.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday, November 9, 2023. We now leave you with Mawa and the song Mata Kore. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow again for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mama, Mata Kore, Unia De, Yauze De. Matakore.